We've left off in Acts chapter 21. That's where we want to go back to. We got a little of Acts chapter 21, verses 20 and 21. I do want to read those two verses again, and then we'll pick up with some additional information. We have Paul. He has finally made it to the area of Jerusalem. He has a lot of money with him from Gentile congregations. There are some Jewish converts, some Jews in the area, who need assistance, and those funds were designed to not only help those Christians, but also to help bridge the great divide between Jews and Gentiles. Acts 21:20, and they, when they heard it, glorified God. This would be James and the elders. Paul has given them this detailed report. He has sort of gone line by line, item by item. We wouldn't expect that every single second of the trip was ticked off, but he at least certainly hits the main points and probably a few small points as well. They get that report. They glorify God in perfect tense. And they said unto him, thou seest, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of them that have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been informed concerning thee that thou teachest all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after their customs. We got through most of verse 20 last week, but I do want to make this next point that's kind of tied into that. You have these Jewish converts, and you would think if you were from a Jewish background, you become a Christian, then from our perspective, what would you do with those things tied in with Moses' law? Circumcision, the feasts, and you know, maybe some Sabbath day restrictions. You become a Christian. For us, what will we be thinking?
I'm done with that.
We don't want that anymore. Those were restrictive laws. Now, Saturday, we can go out and work if we need to, if we have to. Don't have to worry about circumcision. Don't have to worry about the animal sacrifices. All that stuff is past. Thank God we've been delivered from the Old Testament law. That's our thinking for the most part. Now, you do find some people out there in the religious world, they want to go back and say we're under the Ten Commandments or some other things like that. But generally speaking, most people today, when they realize that the Old Testament has been completely done away with, it has been replaced by a New Testament, they are very satisfied with just sticking with the New Testament and saying we are content to leave the Old Testament in the past. Now, if you find someone who perhaps didn't grow up as a New Testament Christian, they came out of some religious background, maybe it was somewhat close to New Testament Christianity, maybe not. After they become a Christian, do you find sometimes that they hold on to some of the tenets, the beliefs, the practices that they had before conversion? Absolutely. And that can vary. It might be if they, for example, come out of a Seventh-day Adventist background where the Sabbath, boy, I mean, this is the day where you do not do any work. This is, you know, the day for worship and so forth. It's going to be tough. If you come out of perhaps a Jehovah's Witness background and you have been told for a number of years that Jesus is a God, he is not equal with God, when you hear teaching that Jesus is equal with the Father, he's equal with the Holy Spirit, your first instinct might be, well, that's not true. And then you have to make that mental shift and say, well, that was the error that I used to believe in. Yes, Jesus is equal with the Father, equal with the Holy Spirit. That kind of thing is not new, and that kind of thing is seen in the Bible, because he talks about all these Jews that have believed. Well, that's not just faith only, but here you again have a part for the whole. You have a synecdoche, and that represents belief, confession, baptism. But after these people converted, he said what? They're not just still sort of interested in the law, they are zealous for the law. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they were interested in every part of the law, but at least there were some aspects of the law that as Christians they did not want to leave behind. You find sometimes people, and there would be different ways perhaps to demonstrate this, but we would maybe say that some people are welded to certain things. For example, we might say, you know, here's the guy, you know, when we encourage him to move, or we can encourage a family to move, and they say, I could never move. Why do they say they can't move? I'm welded to this property. I'm welded to this state. I'm welded to this city. I'm tied to this city for what reasons?
Job.
All right. My friends are here. Don't have any friends anywhere else. These are my friends, so I have to stay here. My job is here. I can't transfer. There's no way for me to move my farm out of state. This is where I have to be. And people will sometimes feel like that. And if you were a Jew and you had thousands of years of Judaism behind you, when it came to that religion, would you not feel welded to it? I mean, this is part of your identity. This is part of who you are. This is just part of life. And becoming a Christian and turning your back on all that would have been very, very difficult for a lot of people. And just as today people sometimes struggle to leave behind some of the old beliefs, that certainly would have been true for these people. Stan, we're going to raise a hand, okay?
Well, you might ask yourself the question, why does the person who walks the tightrope or walks the high wire have a net? And I can just easily see these people who have converted, but they've got a rope tied to the old law. It's like
the fail-safe.
Yeah. I'm just not absolutely sure I'm going to give that up, what I already knew.
And that very well could have been part of it, because Moses, definitely from God, the law, definitely from God. That system had been in place for a long time. It was still in place. If you're in the area of Jerusalem, you can see what's taking place as far as the priests, the temple, a regular basis. And people, it's like asking, did we put down the garage door? You're pretty confident that you did, but, you know, maybe you didn't. And if you've come over to become a Christian, well, yeah, we got Jesus and the miracles and the apostles and all this seems right, but I mean, still, are we really sure? So there is this sort of tug of war going on in the minds of at least some people. And then we've got these folks who are Paul's enemies or Paul's agitators, and they're fueling some doubts, we might say, among other things. Gary, did you have a hand too? Okay.
And even though a lot of it is, yay, we don't have to do this and this and this anymore, it's in a way easier. To Jews, it wasn't just a religion, if you could say that. It was a culture. And
yes.
It was so ingrained in every facet of their life, and to have to leave that would take a lot of work.
Yeah, and that's why I use that word welded. We could use in our area, when you look at the Amish, there are people who leave the Amish, and yet if they do that, at least in some and perhaps you might say many circumstances, years later, can you still see the stamp, the imprint of the Amish upbringing? You can. And you don't have to be an expert on Amish culture. You can, you know, see some mannerisms and some other things, listen perhaps to how people talk. Maybe it's reflected still years later in the dress. And you might be tempted to ask, or perhaps they'll just come right up and say, I used to be a member of the Amish community. Well, there would be some cases where we might be surprised, but more often than not, we probably can say, maybe it's the hard work ethic, or maybe it's a desire to do things with less technology. Those things just become, to use your word, Gary, so ingrained in people, they carry over perhaps until death. That it? Okay, let's say some other things about Paul. Here he is, and he's having some accusations launched against him. That is by no means new for him. But this controversy that's swirling about, was it due to Paul failing to teach the truth? No. He has taught the truth, but there are some people who are doing a really, really good job as far as misrepresenting what he's been teaching. There were some Jewish converts who come to believe that Paul was teaching, that is, present tense. He was teaching how many Jews? All the Jews. Now, when somebody comes along and says, everybody is upset, all the people are angry, when you hear those things, does your brain kind of mentally stop and say, let's pause right here before you go any further?
Yes.
Mine does. How come?
All is.
If you're telling me it's all and everybody, there is no one that is excluded, I find that, unless we're dealing with one or two people. All right. Both of them are upset. Okay, well, if there's only two and both of them are angry, we can say that they're all mad. But generally, if you have any size at all, let's say 30 people, 50 people, 100 people or more, when someone comes along and says they're all upset, that could be true, but chances are it's not true. Now, maybe you have 10% or 20% or 50% of the group, they are upset, and perhaps they're very, very vocal. But that certainly does seem to be one of the things that they use to agitate the people here. What were they saying? All the Jews living where? All the Jews living among the Gentiles. All those people, all those Jews were being taught something by Paul, and what was the allegation? Paul is telling them to forsake Moses. We'll talk about that word forsake in just a minute. And not only that, he was telling them some other things, right? He was telling them, look at the end of verse 21. When it comes to your kids, you don't have to circumcise them. Don't circumcise them. And when it comes to the customs, the practices that we got from Moses, do what with them? Don't walk. Don't follow those practices. Now, here's a little point that you might overlook easily. Look at Moses. What's said about Moses? You need to forsake Moses. Was Moses still around?
No.
Moses had been dead for a long time, right? So was it really forsaking Moses? All right. Here is where you have a metonymy. We talk about metonymies from time to time. A metonymy is where you say this, but you really don't mean this. You mean something else. So Betty's exactly right. Here, forsaking Moses doesn't mean the person Moses. You can't literally forsake him because he's been in the ground for a long time. God, you know, God dealt with him. But forsaking Moses' law, the practices that Moses brought. Here's another interesting thing, I think, which isn't maybe worthy of mention. The noun forsake, if that were spelled out in English, it would be spelled A-P-O-S-T-A-S-I-A. Apostasia, that sounds a lot like what?
Apostasy.
So here it is. It's only found here in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3 where it is rendered falling away. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little more? Okay, let's see what else we have. Now, we're not told who was trying to convince these Jewish people there in the area of Jerusalem that Paul was engaged in wrongdoing. It could be one more example of Judaizers. We have those people popping up at different times in Paul's life. These Judaizers are encouraging people to one degree or another to go back and follow to keep the Old Testament law. So maybe the problem was coming completely from them, maybe partially from them, maybe not at all from them. Then you also have Paul's enemies. You have some unconverted Jews who had posed some problems for him in places like Greece and Macedonia and in Asia Minor. And it could be that, you know, they're working the people to create Paul and create opposition for Paul. We do know when you start looking at this, and I want to go back for just a second, Acts chapter 6, verses 11 through 15. We'll ask for those verses to be read in just a minute. When you start looking at this, this is not a new problem. This issue, as far as the first century church, has been going on for a while, and it continued for a while. And there's a practical lesson in there that we want to bring out. Acts chapter 6, starting with verse 11 and going down through verse 15. Who has it and wants to be our reader? Gary, to you.
Then they secretly investigated men who said, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God." And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes, and they came upon him and seized him and brought him before the council. And they set up false witnesses who said, "This man never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and will change the customs that Moses has delivered to us." And gazing at him, all who sat in the council saw that his face was like the face of an angel.
Change the customs. Destroy the law. Early in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 6. Now we're way over here, many decades later, in Acts chapter 21, and do we find the same kind of thing being brought up? Yes. Is there a practical lesson in there for you as you think about the church today? Here's the parallel. Here is this issue. It just keeps popping up in different forms. It is impossible to completely shut down. Doesn't that happen today in the church? It could be in a local congregation. It could be in an entire country. But the church is hit with some kind of issue, and you know, you try to bat it down over here, and then it pops up over here. And then you go after it over here, and then there's another form of it that springs up somewhere else. When we see that kind of thing today, we should not be surprised. This has been going on for a long, long time. And in the first century church, it continued for a good while. In fact, we know that this kind of thing was an issue for at least 40 years, maybe even beyond that. If the church was established in, let's say, 30 or 33 AD. And remember when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans? What year was that? About 70 AD. So that's about a 40-year spread. In Matthew chapter 24 and verse 20, Jesus talked about prayer. And he talked about prayer in conjunction with the destruction of Jerusalem. He said, when it's time for that, he said, you pray about the day. He said, you pray that the destruction is not going to come on what day? That's right. He said, you ask God that the day will not be Saturday. How come?
Because we weren't supposed to do anything on that day.
Well, there was that. But what else?
They'd be in worship.
There's another reason. Jerusalem had gates. Yes, the city gates were closed on the Sabbath. Now, if the Romans are coming in and they've locked the gates and you want to flee, guess what? You're not going to get out. You're going to die. So Jesus told his people, heaven will pay attention to your prayers if you want to pray about the date or the day. And that's going to be on some other day than Saturday, and then the gates will be open and you can flee. Well, if that was still something that Jesus had to give his people a warning about 40 years later, what does that tell you about the power of the Jews and their commitment to Moses' law? Four decades later, this is still an issue that people are struggling with, and certainly Christians. Thus, today, you might feel like, as a Christian, you're battling some form of immorality, or there's some problem in the church, and you're wondering, is this ever going to be killed off in my lifetime? The answer to that might be no. Now, anything you want to say before we move down a little more?
You know, Israel and even the Jewish people throughout the world, they still practice a form of Moses' law in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we think about the synagogue in Colleyville. They were apparently involved in a Sabbath service, and you can find some Jewish synagogues. If you've never seen what happens in a Jewish synagogue, go to YouTube and pull up Jewish synagogue worship. You'll probably find that there's a lot of singing there. But yes, they, to one degree or another, are still trying to do that today.
Was anyone there other than the four or five people, because they said they were doing Facebook?
I didn't get that. I knew that there were only about four people there. There was a rabbi and I think about three others. So it was not a synagogue that was, as far as actual attendance, physical attendance, it was not well attended that day, and that seemed to maybe make things a little easier. Okay, let me give you another note here that I wanted before we get down too far. Paul knew the truth about this stuff, and he was very firm in what he taught. For example, you look at the book of Galatians chapter 4, verses 1, 10, and 11. You also, whoever wrote the book of Hebrews was also very, very clear. As far as Moses, there was a time for him, there was a time for the law, but those practices associated with Judaism have been replaced by the New Testament. Is there any indication that we have that Paul had ever tried to tell the Jews, you can't circumcise your kids, can't participate in the Jewish feast day, got to leave everything with Judaism alone? That's a yes or no question. Nobody's brave enough to at least guess? He didn't. In fact, do you remember over there, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 6 would be one passage where Paul said, circumcision doesn't avail anything, and choosing to not circumcise, that doesn't avail anything. You can go this way or you can go. It's kind of like a person says, well, how do I get down to the store? And we say, well, you can go this way or this way. They're both equal in distance. The roads, you know, you're not going to have potholes this way or a lot of traffic that way. You're looking at two different ways to accomplish the same thing. You're not going to spend a lot of extra gas one way or the other, so you choose. And that was essentially Paul's point about circumcision. We saw back in Acts chapter 16, verses 1 through 3, Paul wanted to take a young man, someone who did some preaching, someone who was very helpful to him, a son in the faith, Paul described him as, and who was that guy?
Timothy.
And what did Paul do to Timothy before he took him on the trip? He circumcised him. So if Paul believed that circumcision was something that you just can never do, guess what? At best, he was a hypocrite, or at worst, we would say he was a liar, or he was really mixed up. Then a couple chapters later, in Acts chapter 18, you have Paul taking a vow while he was at Corinth. And you find, as you look at other places in the New Testament, Paul, for example, talked about Acts chapter 19, some other places, 1 Corinthians 9, he wanted to, when it came to the Jews, live as a Jew. And when it came to the Gentiles, unless that was going to contradict some point of doctrine, he said, I'll live as the Gentiles. Be like going to somebody's house and they say, you know, we're meat eaters at this house. We're meat and potato eaters. Well, okay, I'll eat meat and potatoes at your house. And then, you know, you go over to somebody else's house, maybe for a week, you're out of town and somebody's giving you hospitality, and they say, we don't like meat, we are vegetarians. Well, guess what? If you want to be a good guest, what are you going to eat?
Vegetables.
All right, you're going to eat the vegetables. You're not going to be bringing in McDonald's burgers, and you're not going to be bringing in steaks to that house because that's not the way that they're set up. So you can go either way, but Paul tried to do that as well. But there were some people, they misunderstood Paul's mission, they misunderstood his motivation, and they had an agenda, so they started to circulate rumors about him, and that began to create some serious problems, as we're about to see. One said rumors thrive on half-truths, prejudice, and outright lies, and that's true, and that really created some problems for brethren in Jerusalem. Anything that you want to touch base on before we look at verse 22? All right, Acts chapter 21, if you've just joined us. What is it there for? Now, this is still coming from James and the elders. They're thinking about Paul. They're glad that he's there. But they're also thinking about all these bad reports that have been circulated about Paul. False information, which says you can't do this, you can't do that. You've got to leave all the Jewish stuff alone, even though, as we've just shown from Timothy and Acts chapter 18, that was not true. He says, they will certainly hear that thou art come. It's helpful sometimes to, well, let's look at this from a different perspective. If you are going to get into the car wash business, what do you think step number one might be? You know, you move into a community, you want to set up a business, and you think, I want to get involved with car washes. I want to have a car wash business.
Do a survey to see if the need is there.
Well, okay, I wouldn't have answered the question quite like that, but you're on the right road. Gary, do you want to take a shot at it? Well, that's important too, but anything else?
You need some money.
Yeah, that too, but anything else?
Just make sure there's not another car wash.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a community of 5,000 people and they've already got 6 car washes, do you think that's probably going to be a problem for your business?
Yes.
Yes. So let's see if there's a need. Let's see how many other car washes are out there, you know, before we do that. Now, you said, well, how does that illustration relate to Acts chapter 21? It relates in this way. If you're going to get into the car wash business, you need to know what's going on in the community as far as car washes. Here, with these people, James and the elders, did they know what was going on in Jerusalem? Did they have, we might say, their ear to the ground? Yes. And they knew that there was this issue as far as a number of converts wanted to continue to hold on. They wanted to cling to some of the stuff in the Old Testament. Now, you can relate that to what we talked about before. It is very, very tough to shake some people loose sometimes from certain beliefs and practices. And if you've got a lot of people who are, I'm reading between the lines a little bit now, but if you've got a lot of people who are becoming Christians, is your first priority probably going to be shaking them loose from those Jewish practices like circumcision, which really don't matter, or are you probably going to be focused on some other things?
Other things.
I think you're probably going to be focused on some other things. So this, as far as I can tell, has sort of been a back burner issue for them. But when Paul shows up, now what's true? We're glad to have you in town, but they are going to hear what? They're going to hear that you have come. You have arrived. You are in town, and that's going to spell trouble. Well, we don't know exactly what kind of trouble they suspected, and maybe they didn't either. But if you have these agitators and you have enough of them, and they start going out and stirring the people up, what might be the end result? We've seen it in our country recently. You have mobs, and you have riots, and that also could have done some serious damage to the church. Well, because of the potential for controversy, Paul's able to say, look, you know, I brought the money, but how easy is it to pacify a mob? It's very difficult. I mean, if you have people who have been, you think, for example, about Jesus just before the crucifixion, people are crying out, crucify him, crucify him. That's difficult to shut down. And these elders and James surely realized that the money was likely going to do some good, a lot of good. It certainly was needed, but this was not going to be a complete solution to the problems that existed. Now, you may remember that back in Acts chapter 15, we've got Paul and we've got Barnabas and some other people gathered in this same area that is Jerusalem, perhaps even the same place. And back there, if you go back to Acts chapter 15 and verse 1, there were some people, some Judaizers, who were saying that if people wanted to be saved, they had to be circumcised. And Acts 15 and verse 28, the people who were there said, it seems good to us. The Holy Spirit was the one who had decided what was right. But now they got that fixed up. But now we've got this sort of the same players, I think, for the most part. And now they are dealing kind of with the opposite issue. If the Gentiles did not have to keep Moses' law, that was Acts 15. Now the question is the Jews and their relation to Moses' law. Certainly they didn't need to keep it. Christ solves the problems for justification. But the question is, what if they want to continue to observe some of the practices like the feast and some other things? What if they want to circumcise their kids? And that really could have been a hot button issue. All right, anything that you want to cover before we look down at 23 and 24? Stan?
Well, you made the comment a couple of times that whether there was circumcision or not circumcision, that really was no big deal, of course, following after what Paul said. But it seems to me like it makes a difference on why, if these people are following circumcision because mechanically that's what they were used to and they didn't want to give it up, that's one thing. But if they were following circumcision because of they accepted it as part of the law, then that's a completely different thing. It seems to me this is a parallel of what Paul was talking about when he's telling the people, if you don't know where your meat came from, don't ask questions.
Yeah.
Because it's no big deal what it was used for. But if you do know, and then you want to be careful about how you approach it, because it can create all kinds of problems among the people that you're with. So it seems to me like there's, I guess the question becomes, why were the people still attached to circumcision?
Yes, what are you connecting this to? In the case of circumcision, you think that you remember that that was a sign of the covenant for the Old Testament. So if you were a Jew, you'd become a Christian, and you are looking at circumcision as that act, which would be a covenant act as far as a right relationship with God, then Paul probably and surely would have been the first one to stand up and say, no. You know, that's a definite no-no. But, you know, looking back at this from our perspective, circumcision, it's helped some people in a lot of ways. Reduced, as I understand it, some issues related to cancer. There are some health benefits to it, aside from that. And it is a practice which has been helpful in many cases. But those practices, at least as I'm describing them, had no religious connection. So Paul would have been able to say, look, you know, again, the Timothy thing. If you're going to go and perhaps be a missionary and work in an area where there are some Jews, circumcision is probably going to come up. That's going to be an issue. So just as I circumcised Timothy, I think it would be good to go ahead and have those missionaries circumcised. So there will not be any issues on that point. But bear in mind that that is to promote the gospel. That is not to connect you somehow to Moses in the Old Testament. So sometimes there is a lack of clarity. Things can get really fuzzy. And Paul didn't want that, and surely the Jewish elders didn't want that as well. But it was, like I say, something that had to be discussed. And when you're having to go back, it was surely a delicate conversation for a lot of people to tell them, look, you know, you have been disconnected from Moses. There is no religious value there whatsoever. And that had to be a hard message for many. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at 23 and 24. Here is what James and the elders suggest to Paul. Do therefore this that we say to thee, we have four men that have a vow on them. These take and purify themselves with them, and be it charges or pay their expenses that they may shave their heads, and all know that there is no truth in the things whereof they have been informed concerning thee. But thou thyself also walkest orderly, keeping the law. Now, if you let those verses sink in, you think, wow, I got to think about that for a little bit. So here, again, we have the Christians that are meeting Paul and his party at Jerusalem, James and those elders, and they say, we know what's been said about your work with Jews who are living among the Gentiles. You're telling those people, at least the reports are, that some people are hearing, you have to forsake those customs associated with Moses. And they knew that that was upsetting to a lot of Christians as far as converts, Jewish converts, there in the area of Jerusalem. So they've got a suggestion that's put forth in these verses. And it's basically a way of saying, Paul, you show sympathy, you show support for these Jewish customs. Now, if you're going to help these four guys out, would you say that they were probably rich or poor? I'm going to put them in the poor category, and that's why the suggestion is made, Paul, you pay for their expenses. Verse 23 says that they had taken a vow. That vow was not defined. A lot of commentators, and I would put myself in this category as well, think that that's probably a Nazirite vow. You read about the Nazirite vow back in the Old Testament. You can get that back in Numbers chapter 6, especially verses 14 through 21. There were times where people took that Nazirite vow. For example, for us, I mean, if people touch a dead body, they're probably thinking, well, let's just wash our hands. And but that was not true for the Jews. If you touch a dead body, you are defiled in a ceremonial sense. And you have to go through a ceremonial purification process. And for the Jews, after the temple was up and running, that would have been done at the temple. 7 days had to pass for a Nazirite to be purified. And the people involved with that, you get to day seven, you shave your head. On the eighth day, you bring an offering that had three parts. There was a male lamb, there was a female lamb, and there was one ram, along with the cereal and drink offering. And again, Numbers chapter 6, verses 14 through 21. Now, as you look at the text, Paul was apparently not asked to take the vow, but he was asked to participate in some other ways. Join these men, go through the ceremonies, and it looks to me like Paul would have been there at the end. From what we can tell, as far as this is a more Jewish tradition, the vows were generally, and I'll mention this another time, probably next week, the vows were generally 30 days, but that could be abbreviated down to 7. And if you are willing to join these men, pay the vow, then all the Jews are going to know that there's how much truth? There is no truth whatsoever in what they had heard about you. And it's going to show Paul the people that when it comes to the law, what do? You keep it. You walk orderly. Now, does that sound a little problematic?
Yes.
It does. And this is one of the passages that's really, really puzzling. And one of those puzzling questions involves Paul and his right to engage in the vow. Does he sin when he participates in the process? Well, nothing is said one way or the other, but the end of verse 24 does leave readers with some questions. We know that he did say that Moses' law was finished. Galatians chapter 3 deals with that. Romans chapter 7 and verse 4, we were there some time back. Paul in Galatians 3 says the law was a tutor to bring us to Christ. He says Christ has come. We no longer need that tutor. Romans 7, 4, he says that we are dead to the law. The circumcision that we talked about, all of that stuff has been done away with. Now, the people who argue that Paul did right on this occasion would point back sometimes to Acts chapter 18, verse 18, where Paul took that vow when he was in the area of Corinth, I believe it was, back there, shaved his head, and they would say, well, if that was a problem and we believe it wasn't, then let me restate that. That wasn't a problem. We don't believe that that was a problem, and that's also the view that we have here. A little later, you just have to turn over to about a page to Acts chapter 24, verses 17 and 18. This is something else that's a little strange. In 17, now after some years, I came to bring alms to my nation. Well, that's what we're talking about in Acts chapter 21. And offerings, amidst which they found me purified in the temple with no crowd, nor yet with tumult, but they were certain Jews from Asia. So, Paul, as he's dealing with Felix a little later, he goes back and talks about this. He talks about this in a very favorable way, and that to me seems kind of odd. I mean, if this was a sin, this was something that Paul shouldn't have done, then he almost glorifies the sin over here in Acts chapter 24. So that seems pretty peculiar if he was in the wrong. Then you have this issue as well. If Paul actually did what was wrong, he not only would be faulted, but who else? You have to go back and also blame who?
James.
All right, James and the elders, and say that, and that's certainly possible, that they also were guilty of sin. There is another explanation. This goes back to 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that I referenced a little bit ago. Paul said, I've become all things to all men. To the Jews, again, the meat and vegetable illustration that I used, you know, when we're dealing with these people, this is important to them, this is what I'll do. When I'm dealing with these people, this is important to them, so this is what I'll do. And that's not being two-faced. Ever go to somebody's house where they want you to take off your shoes?
Yeah.
All right, when you're in somebody's house who wants you to take off your shoes, what do?
Take off your shoes.
All right, unless you probably don't want to be invited back, you take off your shoes. All right, you ever been invited to somebody's house where they don't want you to take off the shoes?
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you're in one of those homes, then chances are if they express to you, leave your shoes on, then you should probably do what? Leave your shoes on. Now, somebody says, well, I went to his house yesterday, took my shoes off, and went to his house and left my shoes on. Now, if you didn't have any other information, you might think that the person was pretty mixed up, right? But if you knew the people, the homes being described, or the person added a few more details, you might say, oh, now I see. You know, you were told to leave your shoes on here, but you were told to take your shoes off here. So acting one way, house A, acting another way, house B, because the circumstances were different. And that's really what Paul says. McGarvey, in his new commentary on Acts, I think this is a quote which is worth sharing. He said the only difference between Paul and the most extreme Judaizers, of whom there were doubtless some of the multitude of believers to whom James referred was that the latter held these observances to be matter of duty, while he held them to be matters of indifference. And that is right. They're dealing with the same issues, but Paul said these are things that don't matter. You can do them, not do them. But the Jews who were creating problems had a different view. There is another explanation which McGarvey proposed. I don't like it. I think that this really is a stretch, but it goes back to Peter. Remember in Acts chapter 2, Peter says, and God's going to bring in the people who are far off, the Gentiles. Did Peter immediately understand, or did Peter immediately accept that fact? No. It takes him 10 years, and then God has to do the special stuff that leads him to the house of Cornelius, and then the tongues fall, and Peter says, I finally get it. The Gentiles are welcome. So it took Peter a while to get things straightened out. McGarvey suggested that that is what we have with Paul. Paul does this, and he does this without fully realizing what he's doing. Now, to me, that really seems to be a stretch. Because Paul does, and McGarvey would add a little bit more and say, well, Paul finally figures everything out a little later, just like Peter did, and then Paul really drops the hammer on this stuff later. I don't like that for a number of reasons. That just doesn't sit well. So, again, I'm not going to say that it is impossible, but when you look at that, Galatians is a fairly early book, and when you start looking at passages like Galatians chapter 5, verse 6, 6:15, that explanation really seems to be a stretch. I do think that there is maybe another consideration here. Do you remember under the Old Testament law what happened with a woman after she had a baby? What was her condition? Yes, or there was that ceremonial defilement. There was no sin in having a baby, but there was that ceremonial defilement that had to be dealt with. And Paul's act of purification then might be in that same category, where he doesn't see this goes back to Stan's point. He's not doing this for the forgiveness of sins because he recognizes that Christ is the only one who can forgive sins. He's not going to be involved in the animal sacrifice, but he is one who is going through this procedure to win people, and he looks at this as the observance of a national custom. Now, if that's true, I want to be, I guess in my younger years, I was always tempted to look at this and say, well, Paul wasn't sinless, and that's true, and here's an example of him sinning. I think I've backed off a little bit as far as that view in my later years, but I would be willing to say that this probably was not the best choice. And I say that in part because you, as you continue to read through the account, you find that this did not go that well. So sometimes people have an idea, and the intentions are good. I believe that is probably what we're dealing with here. But the end result is not what people hope to achieve. And that seems to be what happened. So my best assessment is that Paul was on shaky ground here, but whether or not that shaky ground actually crossed the line and we can say that he, James, and the elders sinned with this suggestion, that to me might be just a couple steps too far. Stan?
Well, back to this thought that I brought up before, whether it was considered to be just a mechanical thing or whether it was actually keeping the law, Paul may have been looking at it more on the one side, whereas the Jews were looking at it on the other side, and that's why it created so much of a problem for him. But it also seems to me like, just thinking about Paul himself, that he would have thought, this is going to create a problem for me, because it's the old three steps forward and two back situation. And now, if I do this, I may placate them for the time being, but I'm going to have to turn right around and be sure that they understand or know that this is good.
Yeah.
So it seems like a sticky situation.
It does. I mean, you know, maybe we're dealing with a situation where they should have had more faith in God. There are times where, even today, all of us have been there. You're looking at a set of circumstances, you're thinking, what do we do? And rather than wait on God, sometimes people plunge forward and do something, and it turns out to be ill-advised. Maybe not a terrible disaster, but it's not the best choice. That could have happened here. There are just not enough details to draw some hard and fast conclusions. And like I say, in the younger years, I took a harder line on Paul making the wrong choice here. I softened that a little bit because maybe he did, maybe he didn't. It's just really hard to say without more information. But we do have the basic facts, He does join these guys, asks to pay their expenses. He's willing to do that. And to a limited degree, he does participate. But again, that could be, he's looking at this in terms of 1 Corinthians 9, to the Jew, I became a Jew, and this is going to help advance the cause of Christ without causing any great difficulty. Well, that last part was not quite true as the story continues, but at least that surely was his hope. Anybody else? Betty?
Can you make a comment that some said Paul, this proves that Paul wasn't sinless? Are you saying Paul is considered sinless every year?
Well, I think people sometimes have that view, that he was sort of so up there. But we do have to acknowledge that Paul was guilty of sin, and this could be one occasion where he was guilty of sin. He called himself the chief of sinners.
Yeah, I know, but I think he was looking back there to before he became a Christian, but even after he became a Christian, his fleshly body still fought with his spiritual.
Right.
So there had to be times. I mean, Christ was the only sinless one.
Yeah, and that is exactly right. He was, he said, I am, that's present tense, chief of sinners. So the past, he certainly refers to those times where he was a blasphemer, injurious, a persecutor, but still, he did understand that he had some personal shortcomings as far as God's law. And as I said, sometimes in the past, oftentimes I looked at this and thought, yeah, this is one of the instances where Paul sinned. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But even if it's not, as you rightly mentioned, there were still times in his life when he did sin. A quick aside here. There would be some people perhaps who would look at this and say, well, aha, because of what Paul did, that would allow people who are involved with mission activity on pagan fields to go and engage in pagan worship. Or that would allow people to go and worship with denominational groups. No, that is not a parallel. And one of the reasons that these items are not parallel is that Judaism had been a divinely appointed religion by God. And it was something, as I mentioned to you before, destruction of Jerusalem, that pretty much put the nail in the coffin. But up until that time, the Christians were having to deal with these various issues. So this was something that God had given, had a stamp of approval. You don't have that as far as denominational groups and pagan worship outside the country.